Go ahead, Katie.
Okay, so this is chapter 4 in the Virtual McLuhan. The title of the chapter is The Professor and the Publicist, Tom Wolfe, the Firehouse Boys, and Marshall. So this is about Marshall working with the big ad firms, with the Mad Men.
Yes, Howard Gossie, that's
like
right.
Right, so in the 50s, he started to get fascinated, now this is Marshall, with the power of those who produced the exhibits from the mass media he examined in The Mechanical Bride.
Yes.
And then he started to work with them to supplement his teacher salary because it wasn't that good.
That's
so
right.
Then he gets hooked up with, well, I'm jumping ahead on the page. I had highlighted other quotes. But let's just get right into this. Gossage and
you talking about he gets hooked up with Howard Gossage, which is 1965
or so.
1965. Now, you would read the appendix at the back by Ted Carpenter, where he gives the details of the scheming of Howard Gossage, because Ted witnessed it. Ted didn't like it.
Can you tell
Ted
us a little bit about that scheming, though? Tell us a little bit about it.
No, you would read the appendix at the back of that book. We don't do it right now, but I'm just saying, well, the area you're talking about is elaborated on by a witness, Ted Carpenter.
Right. Ted Carpenter is quoted in this chapter, too.
Okay.
He wrote a little thing about Marshall, like an essay.
Right.
Okay, so Gossage and, how do you say, is it Gerald Feigen?
Feigen, yeah. Say Feigen, I guess.
Okay. So they have some ad firm.
In San Francisco. He's very influential. He has power in the ad world.
Okay. And
Jerry
so they are they're the pump house gang.
Yeah.
Now, I was under the impression that they started to manage Marshall.
They did.
They arranged
all those magazine covers and interviews and got journalists interested, including Tom Wolfe.
Okay. Well, is there anything more you can say about that? Why were they doing that?
They thought McLuhan was great, and McLuhan seemed to be pliable. He was he's presented sometimes in different books as naive. He he didn't know that they'd
the
get
bumbling
big
lucrative. Professor.
Yeah, well, not bumbling, but about he didn't have any money desires. So he suddenly in getting publicity, and then IBM says, "Hey, we want to have you come address us." And I think Marshall doesn't even think of charging a fee. And Gossage and them said, no, you got to charge something. So Marshall starts to say, what, $500? They said, no, $10,000. Like, you know, Marshall was not concerned about that. And so Gossage guided him to ask for a little bit more money. Now, the only side point there is that Ion told me that Corinne, Marshall's wife, by this time, 63, 64, she's getting a little antsy. Marshall's not getting a glamorous life going, which she expected or thought he'd take her somewheres. And she, it's like, you know, buy or die. Marshall, you start getting out there and become somebody. I'm out of here. This is what Ian said.
Really?
That the real reason Marshall was under pressure to start hanging out with these ad guys, which he, I guess, really wouldn't do normally, is that he was under pressure from Corinne. So there's an exclusive right there. Now, I didn't say that. Ion, non-physical, said that.
Right. Was Corinne kind of fancy?
Sophisticated family in Fort Worth, Texas.
Mm.
And, Marshall met her at the Pasadena Playhouse in 1938 because she was on her way to become a Hollywood actress. You know, she was pretty and everything and stylish, and McLuhan's mother was giving a course down there at Pasadena Playhouse, and Marshall goes to visit her while doing research at the famous Huntington Library in Pasadena, and he meets one of his mother's students, which is Corinne, and then he courted her over the next year, and then he absconded with her and took her to Europe, and then they end up in Paris on September 1st, whatever the first day of World War II started. And they heard about it in the news, and they ran to the French border, got the last boat to England, because they were on a honeymoon, but he was, you know, a month-long casual honeymoon, having gotten married on August 4th, 39, and then they had to get to England for he's going to work on his PhD at Cambridge. And they just got there at the last time. Now, here's the bird's eye or God's eye view. At that point, when he runs to Calais or whatever's up there on the French border to get the boat over to Dover,
mm-hmm.
James Joyce is sitting very nearby in a home for his daughter who's mentally ill. All right, so Joyce is right there, very close to Marshall, and Marshall doesn't know Joyce, but here's James Joyce's position nearby, looking after his daughter, who had got screwed up, the rumor is, by her affair with Samuel Beckett, the famous playwright, who was James Joyce's secretary for a period. And at the same time...
Yeah, You and I asked Ion about that, if her affair with Beckett was what drove his schizophrenia.
And Ian said no? Or yes?
I don't remember. I don't remember. I
no,
yeah.
Her name was Lutz, what he wrote. Finnegan's Wake for her, right?
No.
That's what
the feminists claim that. No, he didn't write that for her. But let me just continue. So here it is. McLuhan's getting the last boat to England. World War II is happening, in Poland? Germans are invading Poland, and Joyce is up there carrying his daughter, and France is going to be occupied pretty soon. And going down the channel there, passing right in front of McLuhan on a boat, is Wyndham Lewis. And he's getting the last boat out of England because he's going to be arrested for being sympathetic, supposedly, with the Nazis. He knows he's got to get out of... out of England, so he gets the second. He gets the last boat, and the boat that went before him that he could have got on, it got nailed up there in the Arctic by enemy mm-hmm. subs or something. They sank, but his boat came behind that and didn't sink, and he made it all the way to New York. So look at that triangle. You got this very important triangle on September 1st, 1939: McLuhan, Joyce, and Lewis. It's pretty interesting.
That's really cool.
It's like geomancy, looking at human anthropomorphic geomancy, right? Look at the patterns humans are creating on the planet from the overseer's point of view, whatever you want to call
mm-hmm.
the overseer. So that's a pattern. I discovered that pattern.
You're brilliant.
Yes, occasionally I'm brilliant.
Occasionally.
Because, okay, so Bob, okay, is that part of a mnemonic system that you use in your head or in your
No, you know what Ian says? I triangulate by number. That's how I organize my memory of my knowledge, and so I go by dates. That's how I organize myself. That's triangulation, you know. Ian talks about triangulation, and we all triangulate different ways. My way is by, I think it was, number. And, you know, ever since I was a kid, I would, walking around in Paris, I would add up license plate numbers. So I got into it very early.
My husband's like that. When he worked at a grocery store, he used to try to add up all the groceries as I was bringing it up.
Wait, but is he looking for a pattern? See, I would look for number nine. Nine was the great number. Nine, you know, take any number multiplied by nine, the product adds up to nine. I thought that was pretty
amazing.
That's awesome. Yes.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. And at the time, I wasn't aware of it because I wasn't living in North America, but at the time, all the great hockey players in the NHL were number nine. Oh,
wow.
Rocket Richard, Andy Bathgate of the Rangers, Gordie Howe of the Boston Bruins. That's funny. Boston Bruins. It's been so long. And another guy, Gordie Howe of the Detroit Red Wings, whoever it was at Boston, I don't know, Bobby Hall of Chicago, six teams, and the major guys, the main stars were number nine, which is pretty interesting.
It is.
And then what did Wayne Gretzky do? He saw the pattern, I imagine. So he got his shirt number to be 99. He squared it. He saw the pattern. He says, I'll put two nines on my shirt. and he became the greatest hockey player, supposedly. And look at this. These two, the Rookie of the Year and the Most Valuable Player of the Year, were trained in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, in the rinks that I played on. Isn't that incredible? Rinks and lakes.
That's incredible.
And now the coach from Dartmouth has been hired probably by Sidney Crosby, arranged it. He's the Most Valuable Player. He arranged for this Dartmouth coach to take over his team. It's three people, out of Dartmouth. I mean, that's pretty strange.
Mm-hmm. It is.
You know, we can take credit of that, I think. I think that the... Oh, listen, maybe some of you people didn't hear. We are... It's going to be a big announcement and a big thing this week, later this week, on our website, RNA Drops, what is it, RNAReset.com. You'll be able to see, for the first time in human history, a picture of the iCell. Several pictures.
Wow.
Yep, that's going to be major. Okay, back to your point about McLuhan or whatever.
Okay, well, so it seemed to me that this pump house gang where they hung out, that was almost kind of like a Warhol-ish thing.
Yes,
in San Francisco.
It was the same. Yeah.
Was it?
You can Google Howard Gossage and look at some of the articles. Somebody wrote some articles recently on, you know, his scene that he ran in San Francisco. He was an important scene maker.
Okay. So then Don talks about how they were fact-faking factories, how, like, the news that was coming out of some of these PR firms wasn't true.
Well, that's right. Well, they understood the post-information society. The ad men really understood that. Now, I don't watch Mad Men, but they probably show that in Mad Men, right?
Yeah. I've never really watched it for that piece.
No, they understood they understood the medium was the message. See, McLuhan was describing how these guys live. They knew the content was important. It was the form, the shaping, the massaging of public relations. That was the new game.
Okay. Yeah, I'll look at some of that. And so then there's Tom Wolfe's famous article, What If He's Right? I haven't read that.
No, I had an influence in that. Clay Felker had started a little magazine in the New York Herald Tribune or something, and he was interested in, you know, pretty good raunchy articles, Clay Felker, F-E-L-K-E-R, and he hired Tom Wolfe to do this article, What If He's Right? And it came out in their, like, Sunday magazine thing. And that was the beginning of the new journalism, they called it. It's like subjective journalism, like Tom Wolfe. He's supposed to be, you know, talking about a person, and it's a hilarious, you know, send-up, the article.
Mm-hmm. And it's flattering.
Yes.
And is that the article that kind of propelled Marshall into fame?
Yeah. Tom Wolfe's given great credit, and Tom Wolfe went on to be a good friend of McLuhan's and would occasionally interview him or write books inspired by McLuhan, and there was an important relationship. Tom Wolfe, the very successful writer from the South, has a Southern sensibility, and he is the American king for a while, and the Canadian king is McLuhan, and they work together, you know, American and Canada.
I've never read any Tom Wolfe except for Bonfire of the Vanities.
Right.
And then he wrote this other piece, which was called Hooking Up, about casual sex. That was interesting, too. There's one
Go back
paragraph.
And read. Go back and read his 60s essays. A really good one is Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Yeah, I should read that. How could I not have read that?
Right.
What's that about? Just tell me. Give me a log.
It's about the Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and Tim Leary and the LA's LSD fad in the mid-60s.
Really? Yeah, I would love that.
And, you know, he writes very well, descriptively, of it all.
Mm-hmm. I bet. Is Tom Wolfe still alive? Is he?
Yes, Tom Wolfe is still alive. He's not dead.
How old is he? Is he 75?
Well, let me predict. A lot of heavies came out around 1928, like Gerd Stern, Don Thiel, Andy Warhol, Dave Wurster.
Right.
Let's see if he is a 1928er. I'll just look it up. very close. He's 1931.
Wow.
So that means he's 83 right now.
Oh, that is cute. but he doesn't look like you. He's a cute old man. There's one paragraph from the Wolf article in this chapter. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
He's talking about Marshall, describing him. One moment he would look like merely the English teacher with pre-tied tie on, naive, given to bad puns derived from his studies of Finnegan's Wake, and worse jokes from God knows where. A somewhat disheveled man, kindly, disorganized, the very picture of the absent-minded professor. The next moment, he would look like what he has, in fact, become, the super savant, the Freud of our times, the omniscient philosopher, the unshakable dialectician, that whenever the subject was theory, which it usually was, on those occasions, the monologue began. Then he goes on to talk about how McLuhan was really adept at being in a room and pretending like he was including several people in the conversation when really it was a monologue.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it. On the, I mean, we can go on in the...
Well, this is the thing. My essay on McLuhan, I call him a quadriphenic. The guy had so many... Remember, he's parallel worlding. He's doing all these different things. He's mercurial, probably, to the little man. He has so many thinkings and responses to the environment around him that he looks like a shapeshifter, you know, within a body, and all the shifts that
right.
Tom's noticing. Tom has said at other times that he said McLuhan was like a saint among the New York trendmongers.
Yeah.
He looked like a saint. He acted like a saint. But, yes, he would. He could sometimes look like absent-minded, you know, often... when he had the Monday night seminar, he'd be sitting in the front chair and he'd get ready to start the talk, and he'd start groping into his suit pocket on the inside and look to George, his assistant, and said, "Where's my glasses or my pen or something?" And it was always very close. It looked bumbly the way he would look for something and look in his shirt pocket. It wouldn't be there, but then it would be right beside him or something. That was...
Right.
We used to make fun of that, me and Nelson. We used to imitate that. And George would run around and find all the stuff. I have now my new stuff. Now, what? How can I bring up this quickly? Maybe it's down the bottom. I should play a little McLuhan excerpt.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, this is pretty interesting. This is it. So I would bring up the system preferences, sound flower, and I will play this. I think this is it. It's pretty interesting. Let's see if this works.
Good morning. A lot of our listeners have read about or heard about Marshall McLuhan.
Coming.
Well, Professor McLuhan spoke at the Museum of Modern Art last night, and I think it would be interesting for us to be able to hear him.
You're not hearing it. What would that be? What's required? Am I still on Skype? Check my Skype, Bill. Am I hooked in on Skype? Maybe dead after all these hours. What's it mean when it says, Achieve Radio is using a version of Skype that doesn't support group video and sharing. Would you like to send a link to upgrade?
You're hooked up, Bob.
I wouldn't do that now.
No, I'm not going to do that. So maybe I am hooked in. So how do I get the sound going? Get the volume. I got a feeling that I'm disconnected. Because, you know, I've been on here for many hours. So, Bill.
Says you're hooked up, Bob.
Bill, beam me in.
Bob, it says you're hooked up.
Why won't it... Should I ring the Bill alarm? panic button?
Bob.
The panic button. I just did.
Did you ring the panic button?
Bob, yep. Can't you hear me, Bob?
Does that wake Bill up?
I don't know. Bill.
Been answering, Bob. Can't you hear me?
No, we don't hear you. No. Now we hear you. Could you check my Skype?
It's working. I've been telling you that for 5 minutes, but apparently you weren't hearing me.
So how do I make myself heard on this recording here?
I don't know. Cue it up again. Let me double check everything.
All right. I'm starting it.
Good morning. A lot of our listeners have read about or heard about Marshall McLuhan. Well, Professor McLuhan spoke at the Museum of Modern Art.
Okay, hang on.
And
right.
I think it would be interesting for us
I gotta
to
reset
be able to hear
Turbo
him
Bridge.
Since
apparently that's not working right.
Is that because I've been on so long, or it's in your system, in your internal?
No, it's the
You are connected in HD audio. Please record your name after the tone and press the pound key. The conference is in presentation mode. There are 19 parties in the conference.
Now listen to what Marshall, this is Tony Schwartz doing a WBAI New York radio show.
Bob, are you hearing me now?
Yes.
Okay, yep. Then it will work. You're good.
Okay, so this is Tony Schwartz.
Thanks, Bill, so much. Good
right,
you.
So
welcome.
I'll keep...
Hey, thank you, Bob, to Bill, for getting up and fixing your Turbo Bridge.
Yeah, so we got Sarah, and everybody's muted except for Sarah and Katie, but you guys will remain quiet, hopefully, and we'll listen. It's only about 5 minutes long, but it's pretty interesting, and it's Tony Schwartz, who's the guy who's recording all this stuff. He's a famous sound artist in New York. He's got a radio show in New York, and he's talking about McLuhan. So let's hear this.
Good morning. A lot of our listeners have read about or heard about Marshall McLuhan. Well, Professor McLuhan spoke at the Museum of Modern Art last night, and I think it would be interesting for us to be able to hear him, since in a way his books are really spoken. They're transcriptions of dictation. And I think he comes across best when heard. And here is Marshall McLuhan talking about something that's of interest to all of us today, jobs, with the computerized and mechanized society putting a lot of people out of work. I think it would be interesting for people to hear what Professor McLuhan had to say about jobs.
There are some rather exciting things afoot. For example, if one wanted to talk about the future of work in our world, we know that it has very little to do with jobs as they're presently understood. It has much to do with discovery, much to do with knowing, much to do with involvement in processes, so much so that the future of work is plainly knowing. And there was a time when the job of royalty, the prince, was not to learn any special skill, but simply to grow up. Jacques Ellul, the author of Propaganda, points out that in our 20th century world, the child is the hardest working child in all human history. Our children, in a 20th century information environment, have to process more data than any human being in any previous culture of the world. Our children, from early infancy, are engaged in extraordinarily hard work. And that work is mainly just growing up, because to grow up in a modern electronic environment is a fantastically complex and difficult job. It's also a job which threatens to deprive people of identity and, you know, the personal concept. Because one of the peculiarities of an electronic environment is that people become so profoundly involved in each other that they lose that sense of private identity. This is one of the peculiar cruxes of our time, that people precisely become profoundly involved in one another in an all-at-once simultaneous field of happenings, and then begin to lose their sense of private identity, because identity used to be connected with simple classification and fragmentation and non-involvement. In a world of profound involvement, identity seems to evaporate. Well, the future of work as knowing, the future of identity as involvement, brings one around to a kind of idea of perhaps roles. Instead of jobs, roles. A mother doesn't have a job. She has 60 jobs, and that's a role. A top exec doesn't have a job. He has many jobs simultaneously. That is a role. I think this is happening to all of us in varying degrees. The very speeded up world we live in guarantees that we can all have a highly integrated existence, which really points in the direction of role playing rather than of job holding.
That was Professor McLuhan on jobs and roles. And I also think it would be nice to hear a few comments that I've recorded of people talking about Marshall McLuhan.
I wish he'd do me a favor and see to it that copies of his book are kept in stock.
Marshall McLuhan is a professor of literature who has become, I've heard, an anti-sociologist.
I think he's someone who says what many of us feel. He's exploring and finding patterns that I, as a layman, can understand. I think he's very much interested in people.
I can't fathom the level he's on.
I don't know what his view of man is. That's why I'm at sea with him.
He sort of stirred up a lot of controversy.
I don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan.
Is he a senator?
He writes about artistic things as if they were mechanical things, like automobile driving. And that bothers me. I suppose what he says is true, but on the other hand, it's nothing new.
He is the hot, pot-bellied stove where he can warm your feet and talk to everybody else in the communications business. We've never had a general store where we could sit down and talk communications before. McLuhan is now it. That's the beauty of him.
There's the sound of a much-discussed man of our time and people's comments about Marshall McLuhan. See you soon.
Hello. What do you think of that, Katie?
Oh, it was so awesome.
What have we got here?
That was incredible.
It felt like he was on the phone with us.
We have two things I'd like to talk about tonight.
What's that? Let me see. Where's that? I hit the
three or four generic observations you would make.
How do I mute that?
For the hospital or medical people.
Maybe it's my sound system here.
Then after that.
Yeah, I just had to do that. Okay, so wasn't that awesome?
It was really awesome.
That is an incredible statement. What is the new job? Knowing. There is a lot of ionic words in there.
It really, really, yes.
It said 50 years ago. Imagine someone, what's the opportunity for work in the future? Well, we're all going to turn into robots, or robots are going to do it for us, and we'll have all this leisure, blah, blah, blah. And then McLuhan comes in with something completely real and different. It means you have to stay informed. You have to start noticing patterns. The TV body, the TV landscape will be forcing you to notice what's going on, because you'll feel out of touch if you can't keep up with some kind of pattern recognition. And that's what he's calling knowing. And that'll be the job of the society. Is it, because there'll be so much information, so much the requirement in social life of pattern recognition on all levels, that will weaken all the old hardware industries and all the old institutions. They'll all fall apart because people are being, quote, distracted by information patterning that's required. He doesn't mean like knowing the way Ion means it. It's a job, knowing.
Right.
That's very super original.
Super original. And his voice is just
awesome.
Like a flute. Oh, yeah. My God. It's such an instrument. I mean, you read this stuff, and that guy is right. You need to. It's great.
Yeah, and he has mm-hmm. right on patterns about the kids. The kids are overworked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in school and
yeah.
all that. So
loss of identity.
Yeah.
Loss of identity through involvement in each other's lives, which it was social media. It's just like crazy.
Right. Now, he was like the last public intellectual. And look at the, you have people commenting on him. Those are pretty interesting
mm-hmm.
comments. All the range
mm-hmm.
of response. Let me now, I'll just unmute Sarah.
Who compiled?
Sarah,
do
you have any comments, Sarah?
Who compiled the comments?
Tony Schwartz.
Or
he was a radio. He was a radio tape recorder artist in New York City. He put out many
That's
albums.
What I
wanted to... Yeah.
Okay.
So he was always taping people, and he would put out albums, and he became famous, and he and McLuhan became friends. So he taped hundreds of hours of McLuhan in different situations and other McLuhan-related stuff, and then he was dying from what's the senile thing people get? Alzheimer's. I think he had Alzheimer's. But his wife sold the archives to the Library of Congress for a good chunk of money. In 2008, 2007. And I was trying to get J.W. interested in buying it. But he'd never heard of
McLuhan. Tony Schwartz archives or McLuhan's archives?
Tony Schwartz. McLuhan would visit. Anytime he went to New York City, he'd go to Tony Schwartz's studio.
No, I'm asking you, wife. Right. Are you saying that Tony Schwartz's wife sold those archives of his, of McLuhan.
Yeah. Well, first, are you asking, look, Tony Schwartz, McLuhan would visit Schwartz at his studio at his home, you know, in Midtown Manhattan or whatever, and Tony would put the tape recorder on and have McLuhan talk to him or to other people and record it all. It's legendary,
mm-hmm.
what he, and no one had ever heard them. But now, his wife sold them to, you know, the family sold them back in 2007, 2008 to the institution. I was trying to get JW to buy them, but he never heard of McLuhan and didn't care. And now you can, the public can go and listen to them at the Library of Congress.
Wow.
Didn't one of the INS just recently go do that? Who did that?
Yeah, Sarah Courtney.
Sarah Courtney.
She went there and listened to a couple, and she the other day she recommended a particular one, which I'll get
to. Yeah. Very cool.
But these are amazing. I knew a guy who was a friend of Tony Schwartz, and he had an inventory of what Marshall kind of said, the topics, and I got a copy of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, many, many years ago, 20 years ago. So I knew that what the topics were. They were really good topics, and waited for the chance of my life to hear them, and turned out I could buy them.
Well, okay, so in, that was what year when?
That was about 1966, that's 50 years ago.
That was 66, and you are where at that point?
Yes, well, I'm helping promote McLuhan. I was instrumental in getting Clay Felker to do the Tom Wolfe article.
If he was at Tony Schwartz's house recording, did you know that he was there?
Yes, I knew of it, but I was deep in Secret Counsel 10 work. I wasn't running around being too obvious. You know what I mean? I was actually stealing money at that point.
I'm not trying to, I'm not being paranoid at all. I'm just asking how close in relation you were to
McLuhan. You can read my diary entries. It's always, I would visit McLuhan at his office alone. Nobody knew that I was meeting with him. He knew I had something to do with intelligence. He was smart enough to do it and to know, and we would debrief each other. See, at that time, by mid-60s, I'm forming my own army. I know the Secret Council 10 is doomed, and I'm now creating, making Zappa famous, making LaRouche get operative in New York City, making McLuhan famous. I was building my army. And then you can read my diaries where I talk about that. So I was really covert. And then you see, and then at the same time, I'm going back to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and running a little cult with the kids.
Exactly.
What?
So in 65, and Bobby, what is it? Steve. Okay, who's Steve? That's what I want to ask you. Bobby suddenly became obsessed with his Freak Out album by Mothers of Invention.
Yes,
Steve,
yeah.
can understand now, in 1990, why Bobby suddenly became obsessed with his Freak Out album.
Yeah, now he's not okay. talking, he's talking about, remember, I've switched the names. Now, I'm not going to say who's who, but let me just bring up the names. I mean, the names are Randy, Steve, Dennis, Alan, and Flaps, I think, right? Those are the five guys. Are you there?
Is that you? Are you speaking to me? Me? Because...
Either one of you.
No, that's not what it says here. It is Mike, Karen, Phil, Don, Christine.
Oh, that's... See, that...
Terry.
That is... what's the date? Is that 65?
1965. That's what you just...
Right.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, no, that is not... Yeah, that is the big five. Remember, in 1963, around the time of the Kennedy assassination, I see these kids playing in the Dartmouth High School, playing basketball,
mm-hmm.
and I go and kind of get to know them a little bit. That's Mike, and those are actually their real names.
Right, okay.
Mike
so
is Mike and Randy... Yeah, let me just draw that up here. What's the actual date?
You're too butchy, too, right?
Butchy, who visited here in Maui, and his daughter is Jessica Lucas.
And that's not Flaps?
No. See, the Flaps and the Steve and the Alan and Dennis thing happens in 69-70. I'm just looking at getting to know the kids in 65. I mean, I'm not spending that much time in Dartmouth. I mean, you'll see me. I'm driving down the Park Avenue with David Ferry, for God's sakes, at 65 in New York City. But looking at Randy, so 65. What's the actual date? You got a date there for the diary date? Which date?
I've got 68 right here.
Well, now you've moved ahead. No, the one you said, 1965, Mike. Yeah, what's the date? 1965, what's the date?
Yes. 1965, it doesn't give a more specific
date. Yeah, no, it gives February, it'll give a date.
I'm not reading the diary, I'm reading from Fatic Communion. I'm reading the...
Oh, Jesus, okay, no, come on. That's I'm talking about the diary. Those dates in Fatic Communion are significant dates, different significant meetings, so... Geez, so anyways, look at this.
What now, Bob? I snuck it in on you. Because I'm sorry I streamed that into this. Okay.
Well, here you have 1966. April 29th on my diary, 1966. Bob sat in one of the dressing rooms of the Dartmouth rink. Now, this is where Sidney Crosby and Nathan, whatever that guy's name is, Nathan McKinnon or something, come out of. As the coach prepared Bob's young friends for the final playoff game against Prince Andrew High School. As Bob watched the tense faces of Randy, Steve, Flaps, Dennis, and Alan. See? Now, they're just kids in high school. 3 years later, they're not in high school anymore, and that's when I start doing the, quote, MK Ultra on them. All right? So, actually, I present... Dennis, the actual Dennis, the real Dennis, he's doing what Steve does, the real Steve. And I have Steve, as presented diaries, he's doing what Dennis does. So if Dennis reads these things, the actual Dennis, he would say, wait a minute, me, Dennis, I never did that, but I do what Steve does, right? So that's how I mixed it up. So anyways, I'm watching the tense faces of Randy, Steve, Flaps, Dennis, and Alan. As I was doing that, I thought of Hilliard Graves in the opposing dressing room and Daryl Meigs out in Bedford. Now, those two guys, Hilliard Graves and Daryl Meigs, they make it in the NHL in early 70s. They're very good high school players, but they're at the other fringe high schools. They're not at the Maine and Dartmouth High School. So I'm focusing on the main school. But these guys, Hilliard Graves and Daryl Meigs, actually went on and became pros. So I'm thinking about them. I go, those two players were the only ones that seemed destined for a professional career in hockey. So I'm picking up on their fate. Although this wouldn't occur to anybody else that night or any future night. Later, Bob heard some of his friends' girlfriends, as Jane McGlashan, whose father just died about 2 weeks ago. Just got the obituary sent to me, 94 years old. Judy McLeod, Gudrun Gerhold. and they were singing California Dreamin' by the Mamas and Papas while waiting at the canteen for the hockey game. That's an archetypal scene there in Dartmouth that I spied on, let's say. Are you with us, Katie?
I am. I'm in the scene.
You what?
I'm in the scene that you just described.
Are you looking at it or just visualizing it?
I'm just feeling it. I'm closing my eyes and, like, going
right
in my mind. Yeah.
Okay, so I read you April 29th, 66. So then look at the next date. May 12th, 1966, I'm in Rome and New York. So we have a quote here. Not so well, I don't identify him, not so well-known European businessman. It's actually Licio Gelli. We've got to get a hook, he says. We've got to get a hook into this student unrest that's increasing in the United States. Since their leanings are to the left, it has to be through the socialist parties. Look for someone with a grievance in there. Then it says, Bob flew into New York, and soon after perusing the radical journals for a while, he got in touch with a writer calling himself Lynn Marcus. I said, is Lynn Marcus your... I'm now meeting with Lynn Marcus, who is a professor at the Free School, a little bit up in Columbia, a fringe professor, and a member of the Socialist Party. Dobbs, is Lynn Marcus your real name? Marcus says, it's Lyndon Hermile LaRouche, Jr. What's your complaint? So this is LaRouche. He goes, well, I'm a Platonist. I've made some discoveries that show that the real stream of Platonism is a story suppressed and untold. There is a technological basis for the conflict between Aristotelianism and the real Platonism. So I said, I think it was Coleridge, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who said men were either Aristotelians or Platonists. LaRouche says, yes. And the Romantics, I mean those poets, and the Romantics were certainly no help to my antecedents in that century, my allies being thinkers like Humboldt and Riemann. Riemann was the physicist, a mathematician who had a big influence on Einstein. So I go, so what is your strategy? So I'm going to offer a night class over at Columbia and create a cadre of students who can steer this revolution away, the student SDS radicalism, who can steer this revolution away from its present controllers who have a decidedly Aristotelian utopian bent. So I said to him, I'm a revolutionary myself, and I have funds available for you if you can show me some results and get your plans into action. And then it says, the rest of the conversation was drowned out by Like a Rolling Stone, the song by Dylan, as Bob and LaRouche left the restaurant on West 4th Street. So LaRouche went on and did it. He became, his cadre became key guys in the Columbia student riots in April, May 68. So then, now look at this next item. So now I'm over in Ojai, California a few months later. Just a second. Lost my place. Just a second. So that was with LaRouche. The date was May 22nd to 31st. I'm first in Rome with Licio Gelli, and then I'm in New York. Licio Gelli went on to become famous as the P2 conspirator in Italy in 1981 and suspected of shooting the 30-day Pope. And when you look at the third movie, The Godfather, the third part, you'll see the Licio Gelli character is portrayed in there, and he is presented as the guy who kills the Pope. And the Pope was killed in September 78. And you can read all about it in a British book called In God's Name, which will be propaganda for the Protestant Church against the Vatican Church. All right? So, on September 29th, 1966, in Ojai, California, it said...
Wait. You said, all right? Where did that plug come from?
What plug?
You can read about it. When you just said it, you can read about it in...
In the book In God's Name by David Yalop. Came out about 1984. That is the Godfather 3, which is a very good Godfather, but not talked about much, is based on David Yalop's book, which is, he's a British journalist, and it is the Queen and the Protestants taking advantage of the scandals around the Vatican and the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano Bank. Remember the guy, Roberto Calvin, I think it is, Roberto something, found hanging on the Blackfriars Bridge over Thames River? You guys remember that? No. Anyways, So the Vatican was looking pretty evil, and so the Protestants said, well, let's nail the Vatican. So they got David Yalta to do this book, and then Protestant-controlled Hollywood, British-controlled Hollywood, put out a movie on it. Now, this is interesting
by
history.
Right. But the British control Hollywood, meaning they have the production tools available to produce.
Well, the ideology. You don't see much Vatican Catholic kind of themes in the movies. They're more pagan-oriented and liberal, you could say. And that's more the Protestant church versus the Catholic church.
Okay.
Protestant culture that came out of England is liberal as opposed to the Roman Catholic culture. Are you Catholics? Anybody a Catholic among the two of us
talking? I'm Catholic.
Yes, you would know.
And Catholicism is often, when it is in a Hollywood thing, portrayed like in relation, you got to have Catholics to have an exorcism or like
right.
Mafia-related things.
That's right. And what do you get with the British movies? You get the King's Speech, movies about the Queen, and happy stuff, interesting
mm-hmm.
stuff around the British royalty. You know, you don't
mm-hmm.
don't have too much scandal, like you don't have them being connected to the mafia, do you?
Mm-mm. But, okay, no.
Okay, so anyways, that's a vast generalization. Probably doesn't apply in Web 2.0 times. There's just millions of universes going on. But we're talking back in analog TV time, you know, simple black and white world in
mm-hmm.
iconographic terms. So on September 29th, right. September 29th, 1966, so a few months later, I'm having a pretty busy year. I'm up there watching the hockey rinks and predicting Daryl Meigs and Hillary Graves will make the NHL April 29th. And a month later, I'm with LaRouche after being with Leacher Jelly. And then September, I go to Ojai, California to see my family friend, Krishnamurti, Jiddu Krishnamurti, who was proclaimed a world savior in the 20s, right? You know about that. You might know about that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I write, Bob sat down on the wooden bench to have some soup. The spoken sentence, quote, the rituals of the Order of the Golden Dawn should not be used to establish a new priesthood. That sentence, which I was just talking to Sarah this morning about, that sentence, it says, passed into Bob's awareness, and he turned and recognized the speaker's face. It took Bob a few minutes for him to place it. Seattle, about 10 years ago, during the LSD experiments, he walked over, carefully balancing his soup. So Bob asks, excuse me, but did you live in Seattle once? The person that responds said, did you spill your soup? Which is so much the character of the person, you'll see who it is. Did you spill your soup? Bob looked down. The familiar face continued. I still live there. Then I said, I think we met many years ago. Anyway, did you know that Krishnamurti is mentioned in Finnegan's Wake? The person says, I've heard of that book. But that's what I'm asking this man. I'm looking
okay.
At. I recognize.
I knew that was good. I almost did the same thing, Katie. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And really well with the narration.
I'm talking to the guy who said, I overheard him saying, the rituals of the Order of the Golden Dawn should not be used to establish a new priesthood. So I'm curious about that. I recognize
narration.
The face. And so I ask him, did you know that Krishnamurti is mentioned in Finnegan's Wake? And the person says, I've heard of that book, but I haven't read it. And I said, oh, no, one can't read it per se. One can only study it. By the way, I'm Bob Dobbs. Person says, David Worster, pleased to meet you. So then
nice.
I say,
yeah,
this is how I meet Worster. So I said, oh, you're the man who asked Krishnamurti if he's asking us to experience violence. We had already heard the Krishnamurti talk, and Dave asked that question. It was a good question. Everybody was quiet listening to Krishnamurti talk, and then there was a pause. And then Dave said, sir, are you asking us to experience violence? And Krishnamurti said, yes. And I think there's a documentary, one of many documentaries in Krishnamurti, where you see a photo of that crowd, and you can see Dave Worster in it. I looked at it once. Anyways, Worster, I said, are you the man who asked Krishnamurti if he's asking us to experience violence? And Worster says, yes. What did you think of his answer? And I said, well, he said he is doing that. meaning that's what Krishnamurti does. But for me, Krishnamurti addresses the individual's private citadel of consciousness as the source of spiritual regeneration and ignores the dynamics of the crowd. So now I'm beginning to spring my McLuhanism on Worcester. And Worcester says, that may be so, but when Rai set up the principality of man, and then has me, Dobbs, looking stunned. Rai? Did you say Rai? Who's Rai? Worcester says, yes, it's a concept. And Worcester says, yes, it's a concept channeled by a friend of mine who's a medium. Now, that would be Ralph Doobie, who will die a few months later after he's in Hawaii at this point. But I don't know that. And Worcester's not channeling cosmic awareness yet. So he says, it's a concept channeled by a friend of mine who's a medium. And I say, is that guy, is he here today? Worcester says, no, he lives in Hawaii. His name is Ralph Doobie. And I go, Rai, I can't believe it. I've had that word running through my mind for over at least 25 years. I've never known what it referred to. So that was the shock of this word going through my head. I was kind of, you know, weirdly psychic or intuitive. I just had this weird Rai, and I meet a guy. The guy says it to me. How's that?
Wow. That's magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was drawn to him, right?
Don't be afraid of your magic, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I heard the right sentence, and I was just telling, I was talking to Sarah earlier today about Crowley before the show, and Crowley, and how when I took the awareness development courses in 69, early 70, I read that it was to unseat or undo what the Order of the Golden Dawn was kind of setting up. So you go back
yeah.
to what I overheard Worcester say it in 66, 3 years before I even knew it. Like, I mean, it didn't stick with me at that point. But then I remembered, oh, that's what I heard him say. Now, 4 years later, 1970, I know what he's talking about. But I didn't even, I just recognized his face. Because I'd been with him. I was with the Tim Leary of the 50s, Captain Al Hubbard. And he was doing the famous LSD experiments with Worcester and the gang at the Center of Integration. And one day I was with them. Oh, let me read you that. That's in 1959. This is me seeing Worcester.
Did you do LSD,
years...
Bob? Did you do
well,
LSD?
I always say I don't know what I did. I got stuff dropped in me all over the places, you know, in the intelligence wars. We're always poisoning each other. And I had some great weird trips, but I don't know what caused them. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's a great way to say it.
So here it is. Listen to this. So this is on July 6, 1959. I'm in Seattle, and I'm with Captain Alfred Hubbard. You can read about him in the book Acid Dreams, a very good history of this whole thing. And he was distributing LSD to President Kennedy and all kinds of people in the late 50s, early 60s, because he was the only guy who had permission to have Sandoz LSD and distribute it in North America. So he ran a room up at the Hollywood Hospital in New Westminster, British Columbia, and he discovered Worcester's gang at the Center of Integration in 57, realized these were smart, psychically tuned-in guys and women, and he gave them LSD for 3 years and studied the effects on these, you know, intelligent people. So I don't know about that. I'm just with Hubbard for other reasons. And I said, we're in Seattle. I said, why are you stopping the car here? Captain Hubbard says, you see that house across the street? That's the Center of Integration. Some very interesting people live in there. It's my favorite experimental site for my studies with LSD. I go, why is that? And Hubbard says, because very psychic and aware people are associated with this center, and I think it's important to investigate the effects of the drug on that kind of sensitivity. Anyway, you stay here. I'll be back in a few minutes. So it says, Dobbs watched as the captain walked across the street, rushed up the front walkway, knocked on the door, and was greeted by a young man who appeared to be in his late 20s or early 30s. But Dobbs was startled by his face. He had seen that beaming moon face while under the influence of LSD. Now, that was Dave Worcester.
Mm, nice.
And Dave went to an LSD conference in 1977. California someplace with the discoverer of LSD, Albert Hofmann, you know, Paul Krasner, Leary, everybody, all the drug-a-ratty, the literati, the drug-a-ratty, the Illuminati of that scene. And Dave, nobody knew Dave, and he went up there anonymously, and he walked around. Nobody knew that he was taking LSD way before them, thanks to Captain mm-hmm. L. Hubbard. And he told me that he kept bumping into people who would stop and say, "Do I know you?" And Dave would know him. He says, "I don't think so." He says, "I've seen your face in my acid trips." Now, this was very interesting. Many people saw Worcester, his face, and I saw it myself back in the 50s. And so I'm recognizing the face, but I don't know who it is. I don't pursue it. I'm not really allowed to engage with Hubbard, whatever he's doing there. I can't be nosy. And then I see the face, 7 years later in September 66. And I read you that conversation at the Christian Murray thing, right?
Isn't that neat? That's cool. It's really cool.
So you read my diaries. There are incredible patterns in there.
So the document—I don't want to say documentary, but the capture of Krishnamurti speaking that you can view, or that one can view. Do you know?
Yeah, it could be even on YouTube. There is the Krishnamurti Foundation.
I got it from the library, probably in. I mean, I just got it on VHS from the library in maybe 2001 or something.
Yeah.
And just watched it.
Was
that
it black
way.
And white? This was a black and white.
I would say yes, but it had a sepia tone to it. It had a It had a different color than what the. I thought it was probably British filming.
Yeah.
Or BBC filming, but I don't. Yeah. I'm not sure why I feel like that. Anyway,
it was institutional. I think it was like the national educational thing or public broadcasting. It was an institutional, because Krishnamurti was not known in American culture, so you'd have to be a Theosophical Order of the Golden Dawn kind of intellectual that would even know about Krishnamurti, and then go to this his exclusive place in Ojai, California.
This is neat too, how all this is tying back to conversations over the past couple of weeks. Your talk with Youngblood and Corbin about Crowley and stopping the Order of the Golden Dawn, and now here it is coming up again.
Good point. I forgot that we discussed that with Corbin.
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago.
Let me just say this. I want to point out that what I say to Worcester in September 66, I say, you know, he's saying, "What do you think of Krishnamurti?" And I say, well, he addresses the individual's private civil consciousness as the source of spiritual regeneration and ignores the dynamics of the crowd. I developed that in my essay on McLuhan, and that's my McLuhan angle. And this is why Krishnamurti didn't understand what later we would call the Android meme, the imitation of high spiritual states of awareness by the media environment itself. That's what the New Agers, the Alan Watts, Krishnamurti, Tim Leary's didn't get. Leary started to get there a little bit, and that's why he ended up fascinated with Marshall McLuhan at the end of his life, you know. So back to what you were saying,
Who of those, the first people to really kind of experiment and talk about it or research LSD right then, who was the one that passed away while on LSD? Michael tells me that.
Aldous Huxley on the day Kennedy
Michael's
was assassinated.
He's always like, "You know what, Sarah?" And he has reminded me of that too many times for me to have not brought it up yet.
No, it's an important point. Aldous Huxley, he's getting LSD in the 60s, in the 50s from Captain Al Hubbard. You know, he's part of that network. And Huxley's writing books on it. And on November 22nd, 1963, he took an LSD trip, you know, in California, and I don't know. I'd have to go back and read it. I have to go back and read whether he was aware Kennedy got assassinated or not. But he died on acid.
But I felt like, from the way Michael has explained it to me, it was he knew he was dying, and he took acid because he was dying.
Yeah,
not
maybe that was it.
Only because, but he knew he was going to do that and be the first person to do that, and so he said, "Okay, I'll do that."
Yeah, and maybe he willfully, he consciously died consciously. He made himself die. He committed suicide. See, that's a good
maybe
point
or maybe
there.
Maybe not. Maybe he. Well, that might.
No,
not
no.
Be
I would
point.
Ask Ion. I we could okay. speculate. I don't know, but I would
that's
ask
what I'm
Ion.
Saying. That might not be my point. My point just is that it's interesting to note that he would have been the first person to experience that.
Yes, the first one to kill himself, as far as we know. I mean, there could be anonymous people in the intelligence communities. There were a lot of people doing acid, LSD, almost call it acid. But here's the interesting synchronicity is, in 1977,
You can't skip November 5th, 67. You can't skip up to 70. Well, you can.
What is it? What is it?
Oh, I have no idea, Bob.
Are you quoting the Fatty Communion list?
I'm quoting the knife in my back that's still there. Yes.
Oh, your problem. Okay. Well, wait a minute. Let me tell you this. We're talking about Aldous Huxley. So in October, November 77, Carolyn is we're living in Toronto, but and I'm more down in Dallas. But anyways, we get to hang out in Los Angeles for 2 months because Carolyn takes an elective at the newly formed UCLA Pain Control Clinic, which was the first institution adopting acupuncture and all these Asian modalities that were made aware, the West became aware of because of Nixon's trip to China in 71 or 72. So the footage of Nixon or somebody watching these people have acupuncture, being surgery and operate on while with just needles, freak the West out. Well, there are people who got interested in the medicine and all that, and they set up an official institution at Los Angeles, and Carolyn finagled her way in there as an elective. She had many months off, and so we got to spend a great 2 months there. So while, what's my point? So at the UCLA Pain Control Clinic, there were, hip LA people coming in to get these new modalities, acupuncture and moxie, burning moxie and herbs and all that. So one day, Laura Huxley walks in. That's Aldous Huxley's widow. And, of course, Carolyn always stands out. And, of course, Laura likes Carolyn.
Time?
What?
She's his widow at that point when she walked in.
Yeah, that's 14 years later. He dies in 63. And this is 14 years later, and Laura Huxley is fascinated by Carolyn, so they become friends. And in Laura Huxley's book, which came out around that time, I think, she talks about the plan that Aldous would leave a message. There would be a communication from him that he was alive after he died, and they had a technique or, a plan set up. And she writes about that it got communicated. Whatever it was that Huxley said he'd do, it got done. I don't know what, a book, something got marked or something. So she was into this, she was experimenting with psychic, evergreens, cosmic awareness, ionic stuff. And she met Carolyn, and they became friends. And there's that interesting experiment that she did with Aldous, which I did with a person in New York and got it proven, actually pulled it off, even a more effective way. But go ahead. What, you were going to say something?
Carolyn still would say she's friends with her, or they would say
no.
They're friends? They still, no?
They never corresponded. They just
had
a lot
that period of time.
They had 8 weeks.
And they did that class together.
Not a class. Carolyn
is elective.
It's an elective, right? And Carolyn, first of all, they wouldn't even let her come there, but she persuaded the guy because he had the same birthday as her. So she seduced the guy into letting her come because they didn't accept, just whatever, med students coming in. So she got in there, and of course, did well and stood out, and they start letting her be a therapist. So she worked on Laura Huxley. She was the therapist on
it. Okay.
And that went on for like 8 weeks, and they became friends, but I don't think Carolyn doesn't make an effort to stay in touch unless you stay in touch with her. So Laura, she probably didn't need to keep talking to this, what she thought was a young woman, didn't know that Carolyn was a lot older than she looked. So there never was a follow-up. I mean, maybe Carolyn maybe wasn't interested in following up on it. And, if we bring this stuff up, I'll bring it up, and Carolyn hardly remembers it.
That's so awesome.
She lives so much in the now, she doesn't remember anybody. I got to remember her for the people that are writing or sending her Christmas cards, 40 years later.
Aww.
She does remember her patients. She does remember particular patients that stay in touch.
Oh, okay. That's another thing that Michael talked speaks about a lot is, or often is, he points out that was Worcester a patient?
Yes, Carolyn did all kinds of things with him when he lived in Venice, and we would come out to Venice. Yeah, but Dave was, remember, the guy who turned us onto the D cell. So Dave is the connection to getting the D cell. But Dave always
get to talk to him is what I'm getting at. Is that I guess that's a good. That's what I want to know from you, Bob. Do you still talk to him? Do you still
Dave Worcester?
Him? Yes.
No,
sir.
I don't.
Yes,
I don't. I haven't talked to him since March. March 2013, when he insulted the Ionic movement.
What? What? And so you don't speak to him anymore?
No,
so
he's going to
cut him out.
I cut him out. I'm not talking to him
really?
Unless he.
Are you serious?
Well, what he said.
Yeah, so you had to
I
want to talk to Ion. What's this about? This is so
Ion saw it coming. Ion talked about it. It's a whole drama that's got worked out. I mean, Dave, from my view, Dave doesn't understand the Ionic thing. He doesn't know why we're interested. He thinks, he just says, Bob, you just wanted to break the record of talking to a medium for the most hours ever, and you're just doing talk. He doesn't understand about what we're doing, the drops, the cold fusion, and all that stuff. He doesn't understand the operation. This is a serious thing. And he says, you know, Carolyn's not even interested in it. So he doesn't understand what's happening. And so why should I talk to him? Why don't I put up with his insults all the time?
No, I get it. Yeah, no, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that.
Nobody did. I told the story one time. You probably remember, Katie. Remember I told the story one time?
Yeah,
it's on the archive. Okay, now, Katie, this comes back to McLuhan. I am looking at Krishnamurti in these. This is where I got the, quote, edge on everything. I had a new view of Krishnamurti in these people. I saw that there was something else happening. And that's where
Krishnamurti just like some boy walking on a beach, and Reverend Olcott like plucked him out of obscurity and trained him.
No, Ledbetter and Annie Besant. Ledbetter and Annie Besant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's not even really like a holy person or anything. He's just some cute little boy. I mean,
yeah, who
beautiful.
Gets coddled. He gets coddled and learns all this psychic stuff. But see, what was unique about him? He was a person of destiny because he gets very involved and promoted by the Theosophical Gang. And then in 1929, he decides that all this psychic experiences he's having and whatever he was doing with Ledbetter and he based on as the guru, prophet-to-be, the second coming, he said it was all bullshit. And he got up and announced it and shocked everybody. And that was on the radio. And Phineas Wake has a reference to that radio speech. It's part of the Sean speech. There's many, many historical speeches embedded in Sean's address in Phineas Wake, the radio, blatant radio part. But one of them is the Krishnamurti talk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is Jay Krishnamurti Shem?
He would be Sean. He's the perfect boy. You know, Shem is James Joyce or Wyndham Lewis.
Or Eugene Krishnamurti, or like the other Krishnamurti.
Yeah, he'd be Shem. Yeah, Eugene Krishnamurti would be
That's
Shem.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Jay Krishnamurti, right?
Yeah,
is
he's
Jay
the good boy.
Shem.
And Eugene is the stalker and then rebel. Eugene Krishnamurti.
And
when you listen to the interview with Bob Carr, Katie, that's really important. That really shows you he got to be friends of both Jiddu Krishnamurti and his nemesis, Yuji Krishnamurti. It's a very interesting story.
Yeah.
And Bob Carr is the guy who got, Al Hubbard to come to the Center of Integration with Dave. Dave
so
Worcester
it's all
was part
connected.
Of the input. Yeah, it's all connected. And, you know, we're Bob and Connie, and Bob Carr was a homosexual, and his boyfriend was Connie. So I heard talk about Bob and Connie all the way through the 60s, and nobody knew that was our personal names. I mean, Carolyn was not known as Connie. She made a point of not. Once she started enter into civil society, coming out of intelligence, she became Carolyn. But you will see in the diaries, she's Connie in the 1560s when nobody knows. She's not a public person in Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. We meet Bob and Connie, and it's like a mirror, right?
Yeah.
So, what do we? So, is there anything?
Let me read the last. Read the last paragraph of this chapter four to kind of wrap a bow on.
Yeah, that's what I want to do.
I want to tell you. I really want to interject this for my own benefit. 2 weeks ago, I was at the Salvation Army, and I found a Krishnamurti book.
Yeah.
And I was able to buy it for like a dollar, as well as two other books, one on the Tao with the T-A-O, and then another book by Kabril, maybe? Something?
Yeah, Khalil Gibran.
Oh, Kia Khalil Gibran.
It's not the guy that wrote The Prophet.
What did you say?
What did I say to what?
His name. Say his name again.
Oh, well, I'm trying to pronounce it right. I'll go get the book and spell it for you. But it
right.
Was
now,
it
now
was
which like, Krishnamurti book was it? The First and Last Freedom? That was the famous one, and it started off in the 50s.
I want to know. I can't find it. I know Michael snatched it up and put it with, quote-unquote, his book collection.
That bastard.
I know, right? Because he thought that I only found it to spite him. Because he was looking at something else, and I went straight to the book section. So I know he hit it. But, okay, the other guy is Salem Gibran. And it is called Your Last Goodbye, What Happens the Moment You Die.
Well, how do you spell his last name?
Oh, okay. K-I-R-B-A-N.
Kirban. I don't know that.
Kirban. Okay, and then The Way of Lao Tzu.
Yeah.
The Tao Te Ching. Tao Te Ching.
Right. Who by?
Bob. It's by B, capital B-O-B-B-S.
Bob's?
Yes, seriously. It's translated with introductory essays and comments and notes by Wing Cho Chen. Khan?
Yeah, but what's the Bob's you said?
That's what it says on the side. When you know, if you look at the binding to see who wrote it.
It says B-O-B-B-S?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not Dobbs, but Bob's. Wow.
Right. So, yeah.
Okay, so Katie, let's hear your
your
punchline.
Yeah, so this last quote in chapter four, the punchline, it's talking about the Ted Carpenter piece. It just refers to that. Okay.
Yes, good. Yeah.
In a penetrating biographical and autobiographical reminiscence, Ted Carpenter reveals the quixotic, talented, intuitive individual who could borrow phrases and ideas from virtually anywhere and convert them into a brilliant and illuminating rhetoric. Carpenter's portrait is not of a thinker, but of a magus, a shaman, a ritualistic artist, someone, as he himself suggests, who arises from the anthropological worlds that he studied. Carpenter notes that McLuhan had already crossed over into the world of mana and magic.
Wow,
which he
mana.
He had discovered in modern literature and read about in such sources as Malinowski's appendix to Ogden and Richard's Meaning of Meaning. Okay, I'm going to read on. The domain of phatic community.
Well, let me just respond to that. Carpenter studied, he went up north and studied what were called Eskimos. He lived with them, and he met tribal shamans in his anthropology. And what he's saying is that McLuhan was a white man shaman. He saw McLuhan had the abilities that he saw in the native shamans, which is pretty amazing.
It's so weird. I used to, when I was very, very young, I used to spend all day at a quote-unquote babysitter's. Her name was Charlotte. She was an Inuit from Alaska, and she was married to a man named Tony Swartz.
Wow. That's an Eskimo woman, now called Inuit, married to Tony Swartz. Well, that's a good one, Sarah. Okay, back to... You guys are the, my new cult. You know, pretty soon, while we put out the diary entries of 2012-14, it'll be you guys with your names changed.
Oh, you can use my names.
Okay, the next part's going to go into fatty communion, right? That's what Malinowski wrote about in The Meaning of Meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my book title from.
I think Yes, and notice that too, Static Union, which Sarah's reading.
Yeah, so read the next paragraph.
Which Sarah's been quoting from tonight. Which Sarah has
yes, which Sarah's quoting from.
Tonight.
So read the next part.
The domain of Static Union. Such a McLuhan becomes far more significant than a McLuhan used to authorize academic programs in culture and technology, media studies, cognitive studies, or what you will. The latter activity, while not unjustified, is much more trivial than that of the somewhat mystifying and mystical image that both foresaw the year of closing the second millennium and stood as a dramatic symbol of that very process.
Okay, I couldn't make out what you were saying. Let's go carefully read the previous paragraph, the last sentence, and then read slowly, carefully, what you're saying. So, the sentence before the fatty communion, what's the sentence before that?
Carpenter notes that McLuhan had already crossed over into the world of manna and magic, which he had discovered in modernist literature and read about in such sources as Malinowski's appendix to Ogden and Richards' Meaning of Meaning, the domain of fatty communion.
Did you say the domain of fatty communion?
Correct.
Yeah, Ogden and Richards. Ogden is the one who recorded James Joyce reading from Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. So the famous recordings of Joyce, they were done by Ogden, who was a teacher, I guess, at Cambridge. And I.E. Richards was the famous professor who created practical criticism that McLuhan studied in the 30s. And Richards was a critic and professor, and they're trying to understand T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and the new vorticist poetry and Lewis, and they had to come up with a new criticism to balance off the creativity of T.S. Eliot and those guys. All right?
Well, that's the form of criticism that Marshall's been turned around and used.
Yes, he applied it to post-book media, and then he went beyond that, but that's what Mechanical Bride is, practical criticism applied to non-book media.
Very cool.
Okay, so then now read the next paragraph. I couldn't make it. It's important, but I couldn't make out what you were saying.
Such a McLuhan becomes far more significant than a McLuhan used to authorize academic programs in culture and technology, media studies, cognitive studies, or what you will. The latter activity, while not unjustified, is much more trivial than that of the somewhat mystifying and mystical image that both foresaw the years of the closing of the second millennium and stood as a dramatic symbol of that very process. In this latter figure that ultimately gained the respect and recognition of John Cage, Woody Allen, Stan Vanderbeck, Robert Rauschenberg, Gaston Markovitz, Jacques Langriard, and many other artists. What remains relatively unlearned from that figure, with its strengths and weaknesses as a pop poet bridging modernism and postmodernism, is the vital importance of the arts and literature and their history to the understanding of technology, culture, communication, artifacts, and the process of human perception. What he took to be most important was seldom perceived with the depth of understanding he would have wished. This is particularly true of the importance of the arts and literature and the quintessential position he attributed them as foreseeing the future.
That's right. That's really a great statement by Thiel. Basically, Thiel's saying what I was saying to Worcester, that the world of social mortar that, Ion says is the big issue, that's what McLuhan saw, the spiritual involvement of social mortar in the world of the rock private condition. And so Thiel's right. McLuhan's way beyond the academic thing. And this is the guy that the Evergreen cite when they talk about the 21st century. This is the guy that's very involved with Ion. You know what I mean? That's what Thiel is the most accurate in trying to show that you guys don't know who McLuhan is. He's not a professor. He's not a founder of this or that academic thing. He's this guy way beyond that. And Ted Carpenter understood that.
Yeah.
Did McLuhan understand that?
Yes.
On any level?
He knew his role.
Yeah. Once I heard him talk, I got it.
He knew.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's very, it's ionic eloquence, his voice.
It is.
It's, okay. it makes sense to me in the way that I experience stage fright performing in front of a live audience, and then for some reason I end up having to turn off any amplification because my voice becomes so loud and clear because he sounds so flawless that it's like he can't possibly be saying this and believe
right.
it.
Right. Yeah.
It's not revolutionary because it is only revolutionary and nothing else. That do you know what I mean? Like it's so.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's not revolutionary, it's transformational. Is what Ian says.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. However, everything it's always pumped around him, or I'm seeing it like what he's talking about is everything around him is flashing revolution, revolution, be revolution, and he's
yeah.
just like, here it is.
But this now you go back and read Wyndham Lewis. Lewis was encountered this and dealt with it first. And McLuhan used many of Lewis's perceptions to watch the replay in the 1670s of what had happened in the teens and 20s. That Lewis took on directly with analog media. McLuhan's starting to see the transition from the analog media to the digital Android meme. So
that's what I'm saying about On the Backs of Giants. That illustrates
yeah.
what I'm trying to get at. Can we not say that there was a sacrifice made there so that McLuhan could do that? In retrospect, as those who just view all of this as having happened, and now we get to experience this. You know,
well, they didn't sacrifice. I mean, they could handle the contrast that was brought to them. They expected it from their role. But they wouldn't want us sitting around, you know, commiserating over some contrast they had.
I'll take that answer much. Yeah, I like that much better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Plus,
yeah.
they had fun. When you're doing
yeah.
something that, I mean,
if you're, when you're
so
doing that, he's talking
fun.
At the Museum of Modern Art. He's a hick professor from Canada, and he's talking to the New York world elite, and he knows they have no clue what he's talking about. I mean, that's fun.
I mean, how fun would that be? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You guys, I got to go. I got to feed my animals.
Okay, well, I'm going to play some Ion. I'm going to jump ahead to Melting Titanium number 28 or so. It's really good. I just want to jump ahead and get it
out. And, Bob, I want you to know that I did fall asleep. I was on for an hour and 45 minutes, and then I fell asleep at like 10 o'clock. And then you woke me up at 3, whatever time I called in. I sat
yeah.
bolt right up in bed and had to come.
Well,
and then you played that Marshall for me. How cool is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
That's cool. Now, did you fall asleep during the music?
Yeah, I fell asleep when you started to play. It was like a skit that came on. It was like you started
oh,
to play.
Oh, that, no, that was
thing.
The comedian, David Chappelle.
Yeah.
Yeah, the comedian at the end. Okay,
but
so you
guys. I've been up since 4. I'm keeping weird hours. Like, I keep getting up at 3 or 4, and then by 10, I really am ready to fall asleep.
Well,
wait,
you try
what
to.
Did you play? What did you play of David Chappelle?
Yeah, I played David Chappelle, the comedian.
Of doing what?
Well, what were you going to say, Bob? And then I'm going to say goodbye. What
he was
going to.
He explained the word nigger, where it came from.
Oh, I'm
nice.
Going to go back and re-listen. Was it?
Yeah, Leon sent it to me.
Nice.
And, but you know what you ought to do is make yourself have an alarm so you can show up for the hour after the music and contribute, Kate. Unless you're going to come later, but.
Yeah. Isn't it cool that I contributed at 3 o'clock in the morning, too?
Right, but I want to do the recordings. But anyways, it doesn't matter. You did it, you did it. But you should plan and try to be here after the music so we can, because that's the
that's
lull
what, that's
period.
That's your preference?
Yeah, it's the lull period before Ion comes in.
All right. Oh, man. See, tonight was probably the
Sarah,
first time.
It was great to talk to you.
You too, Katie. Have a good feed.
No, I just want to. I know I've said it to you before, but thank you so much for turning me on to Yolandi. Oh my God, she's so awesome, Yolandi Zisker.
Who?
Your what?
Okay, what?
That okay. Sarah, that the ant word music that you had posted.
Oh yeah,
there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God,
that's
I love
that's what I'm
her.
Talking about. I don't have people
I
to talk to about
so.
These things, so I only read the names, Bob. That's what I was saying. I only really read the names, and I don't know
that's
how to pronounce
so
her name.
So
I can't
cute.
Believe
that she,
yes,
she's so fucking cute. I love her. I'm so old.
Okay, so Katie, go read my diary. The late 60s,
well,
early 70s.
Harmony Korine produced her. Produces them, and that's the guy that made the movie Gummo.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
really?
Harmony Korine. Yeah.
Oh, my God, so, that's so cool. Okay, I got to go feed my animals.
So, Katie, go read my diary, late 60s, early 70s, and read about what I, the MK Ultra, and then you can comment on it.
I would love to because I love MK Ultra. I've read all, I've seen all the Project Camelot MK Ultra. No, it's the kind
right,
of premiere.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See how it was done properly.
Are you MK altering me? Evidently, you are, since you're
yes,
at 3 o'clock in the morning to come. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you have Ion to counter it. Ion's here to, you know, stop Bob from his MK Ultra project as much as possible.
No, just do it. Do it harder. All right. Talk to you guys later.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.